So the name of this talk is How to See the Way in the Midst of Troubled Times and Help Others to Do the Same. And why don't we say the three homages? Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I want to start by telling you a story because a couple weeks ago I had a trip on a Greyhound bus, and it reminded me of a bus trip that I took a few years back, which was a really remarkable experience. You know, we talk about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas constantly appearing in the world, and we like to say, and there isn't anything anybody can do about it. And you can wonder, well, that sounds great. What in the heck are we talking about? When we talk about, there are different ways of thinking about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas appearing in the world, and people have their different experiences of that. Sometimes we're talking about Bodhisattva with a big B, you know, and sometimes we're talking about Bodhisattva act, that, you know, someone has kind of gotten themselves out of the way and there's just the wisdom and compassion is just allowed to come forth. So the situation on this bus trip that I'm telling you about was, I was coming from the Bay Area up here to Mount Shasta, and there was a bus strike down in the Bay Area. So they had taken a lot of the buses off the line. So when I went into the bus station there in San Francisco, there was a great deal of anger and upset because people's buses had been canceled, and people were yelling and very irate, and one fellow was banging on the counter, and the security people were coming, you know, and we're all around, we're going to invite this fellow to leave. So this was kind of the atmosphere in which I got on the bus, that I still had my ticket, and a whole lot of other people got on this bus. There were more people that got on this bus than there were seats because some of the lines had been eliminated. So people were very upset and talking about the fact that they didn't have a seat and, you know, whatever else was on their mind, and there was a lot of anger and, you know, potential violence. It was really a very heavy feeling. And I was sitting in the back of the bus thinking, okay, Koda, this is good. This looks like one of these rides from hell, you know. But I needed to get up here, so I just sat there. And pretty soon the bus driver got on the bus. And she was a woman, a young woman, probably in her late 20s. And she got on the bus. And the minute she got on the bus, people started yelling at her and you know, sort of carrying on whatever it was that had gone on in the station about the fact that they'd missed their bus and they were going to be late, and in any case it wasn't a place to sit down, and going on and on. And she sat down and she said, "Now listen, folks," she said, "I am glad to hear what you have to say," she said, "but I need your help right now. I need to get out of this station safely." And I don't know if any of you are familiar with the San Francisco bus terminal, but the places where the buses are parked are very narrow, and they have these big columns and all. You can imagine this is not an experienced bus driver because she's driving during a strike. So she said, "I'm going to ask you all to be quiet. Help me out here. I want to get us on the freeway safely." She said, "As soon as we get on the freeway, I am glad to hear what you have to say." So people did. Everybody quieted down. She maneuvered out of this, out of the station, got us on the freeway, and then she said, "Okay, now, what is on your mind?" So people started to tell her what their concerns and criticisms and difficulties were. And she listened to it, and she said, "Well, you know," She said, you've got some really good points here. She said, but I'm not able to help you because I'm a bus driver here. But she said, I'll tell you who you can address your complaints to. And she gave them the name of two administrators in the Greyhound station. And then she said, now I'm going to give you a tip. She said, don't write an angry letter because they'll put it right in the wastebasket. They will not read it. She said, you want to make yourself heard, so be respectful in the way that you are stating your complaints, and here are the people that you can send them to. And then she gave, you know, people pulled out their paper and pencil and wrote down the names of these folks. And then after a little while, she said, you know, we've got an awful lot of people on this bus, and some of you are standing up, she said. I wonder if you could work it out so that the older people have a chance to sit down, and maybe some of you young folks who can handle this a little better could stand up. So people begin to kind of look around the bus and, you know, respond to that. And then she said, okay, now some of you are going to be on this bus for a long time, and some of you are going to be getting off in an hour or so. So kind of keep that in mind, you know, with how you arrange yourself here. So people then started talking to one another and say, okay, where are you going? How far are you going? And, you know, people began, then some people got up and some people sat down and some people said, okay, you know, I'll stand up for an hour, remind me in an hour and we'll switch. By this time, there was some camaraderie developing here. And this was a milk run. You know, she was stopping every half an hour because they had taken all the other lines off. So she missed the first stop. And somebody said, hey, you missed that stop, you know. So then they began to help her anticipate when the next stop was going to be because they were all familiar with the terrain and she wasn't. So everybody is kind of working with the bus driver. No, it's coming up in 5 minutes and you go down this street. And at some point, she got stuck in a neighborhood and wound up in a cul-de-sac. This was a really big bus, and she couldn't get it out. So about five guys got out of the bus and, you know, helped direct her out of this cul-de-sac. Meanwhile, you know, people were starting to eat lunch and share their food with one another and have conversations with one another. And you kind of can get the feeling of what was happening here. By the time the bus got up here, people had made contacts with one another, were taking one another's addresses, wishing one another well. It was the most harmonious bus trip I have ever seen, and everybody participated in it. And I was sitting in the back of the bus saying, Kodo, pay attention to this because this is how it is done. This is how this can happen from this really hostile, threatening atmosphere. This woman was able, out of her immense respect for everyone and really listening to everybody, to shift the atmosphere into something that was just, you know, everybody was a big family by the time we got up here. So I love this story because there's so much teaching in it for all of us. To be in the middle of a scary situation and see what can be done to shift it. You know, we're always so worried about scary situations, and it's hard sometimes for us to realize that they can very quickly go in the other direction because everybody has Buddha nature and because we're all a mixed bag, you know. So sometimes you call on one side, sometimes you call on the other. And so when you think about the bodhisattvas appearing in the world, look around. Keep your eyes open. And when you find one, see what you can learn from them. So, So, the Dalai Lama uses the word potential a lot. And you know, in our scriptures this morning, we said all things have great potentiality. It's one of my favorite lines, because we never know, and there is always the potential within each situation. So everyone has Buddha nature, whether or not we can see it. Sometimes we have something in the way. Sometimes they're putting something in the way. The fact that we have Buddha nature does not mean that we're always acting in harmony with it. And neither is anybody else. But once you've heard that teaching, you know, we can't pretend that we haven't heard it. That was one of the earliest teachings that I heard from Reverend Master Jiya when I was in the Bay Area, going to her talks down there. I had a brand new job, and not very long after I was there, they put me on probation because I was very fresh out of graduate school. It's really embarrassing to think about this now. But you know, I didn't care much for the supervisor that I was working with, so I just went and talked to a different one. And this is not something that, you know, it's not something that is a good idea. And a number of other things. So they put me on probation and told me that I had 3 months to get my act together, or, you know, I could look elsewhere for a job. So I went to one of Reverend Master Jiu's talks, and at that time, I didn't really have the nerve to ask a question, but somebody else, for whom I will be forever grateful, asked my question for me. He said, "I'm having a real hard time with my boss. Have you got any advice for me?" And she said, "Well, your boss has a Buddha nature." And something about that just really struck me like lightning. So we say, okay, that sounds great, but what does it mean? What do I do about it? So, you know, what it meant was that when I went back to work, I took a fresh look at this man, at what he was doing, and I realized right off the bat that, so we were a private agency and we had a contract with the state, which meant that he had two different administrations that he was answering to. So when I realized that, I thought, oh, that's why he's making some of the decisions that he's making. You know, he's under a lot of pressure from all of these expectations that he has to abide with. We had funding from the state, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we had obligations. And this this was partially responsible for some of the things that he was doing. And it enabled me to look at him in a much more sympathetic light and to see some other things about him. And, you know, it turned my life around. Now, it never became a case that we became good friends, but we had respect for one another. And actually, I stayed in that agency and worked for another 10 years there. And well, that's a whole other story, which I'm not going to burden you with that right now. But anyway, a lot of changes. And I guess what I want to say about this is you really have to prove the teaching true for yourself. You have to experiment with it and see what the outcome is, because otherwise It's just, you know, something that somebody's telling you. But Reverend Master Jiyu had a way of making you want to do it. And so I think that's what helped a lot of us. So I want to mention something that comes up periodically for me. I have this experience that someone will come to me for spiritual counseling and say, I'm having a trouble with my relationship with so-and-so. I'm having a really hard time with this person. Have you got any, and I don't know what to do about it. They'll say, have you got any advice for me? And I will very often say, well, find a picture of them and put it up on your altar or your dresser and offer merit or offer good wishes or wish them well. And they will look at me and say, I can't do that. I can't stand to look at them. So when you get to that point, really, this is a point where you have to ask for help. Ask for help from Avalokiteshvara. Because it actually takes a fair amount of courage to recognize that that's, you know, there you are with that. And that we are actually cutting ourselves off from our own Buddha nature in that kind of a situation. Now, as scary as that sounds, it actually takes the mystery out of a lot of what is going on right now in the world. A lot of what's going on with us personally, a lot of what's going on in this country, and a lot of what's going on globally. It is not an evil axis out there. There's not some strange thing happening that is outside of each of us. And so we can kind of say, oh, I get it. We're doing this on a personal level. We're doing it on a national level. We're doing it on a global level. So the question is, how much are we expecting other people to change, and how willing are we to change? This is a very interesting little paragraph that I read in a book about the Dalai Lama. Some of you may have read it. It's called The Open Road. It's written by Pico Iyer, I-Y-E-R. He is a journalist. He periodically travels with the Dalai Lama and writes about him and his teaching and his personal interchanges with him, and it's really quite wonderful to have this kind of insight into the life of the Dalai Lama. But one of the things he's talking about is, that is Pico, he says, he's quoting scientists, and he says, so far they have found that those who had meditated for years could lower their heartbeats by 3 or 4 beats a minute, alter their brain scans, even boost their entire immune systems. Conclusive results have yet to be firmed up, but the research suggests that just as so many of us these days are taking to training and strengthening our bodies, supposing we could do the same with our minds. And then he says, if we can control our heartbeats, our theta waves, even the heat of our bodies, perhaps we could do more to control our thought patterns, anger, or perceptions. Certainly, the new neurological idea of brain plasticity, which we're hearing a lot about right now, suggested that we had much more potential for change than previously imagined. The mind was something we have the potential to transform. Okay, now this is the key sentence. So too, therefore, was the world that the mind created. Now, one of the chapters of the Avatamsaka scripture, which is one of the great Mahayana scriptures, has a whole chapter about how we create the world with our minds. And probably you don't have to read it, although it's wonderful. It's an absolutely amazing book to read. But in the meantime, we can just look at our own minds. And that's a really compelling idea, isn't it? That we are creating, and even our own small environment around us. So we actually are a lot more powerful than we might imagine. Yeah, and you know, really, so that's one of the things that we want to be thinking about and talking about here is what is our role? You know, we talk about empowerment a lot. We talk about empowering other people. Actually, the Dharma empowers us. And so I think it's very helpful to think about how we use language, because what it means is how are we actually thinking about things and how are we talking about them. Now, yesterday I mentioned I could be wrong, right, that phrase, and some of you said you've already started practicing with that. And I would encourage you just to continue with that, because it opens up a whole other vista. Many of us use extremes of language. We say things like, this is great, or this is terrible. You know, I love this, I can't stand that. This person is wonderful, that person is a jerk. And we love to talk about the good guys and the bad guys. But have you ever noticed how come we're always the good guys? And, you know, Dogen says in Rules for Meditation, which you all were reciting yesterday and this afternoon, when the opposites arise, the Buddha mind is lost. Because the truth is that we are all a mixed bag. We're all capable of doing great harm at any moment or great good. And things are much more complex than we, what do I want to say? I think we try to make them simple in order to understand them. They're a lot more complex than they appear to be. And I want to focus on that because I think that is a doorway in to help us understand and navigate the situation that we are in. I remember many years ago in Berkeley going to a lecture that was given, a talk that was given by one of our British monks who was down in the Bay Area. And he said, in response to a question that somebody asked him, he said, well, those two things, he said, that you're mentioning, he said, they don't stand against one another. And I thought, isn't that an interesting expression? That must be a British expression. No, actually it isn't. It's just that we don't use it very much. We don't use it very much because we are used to polarizing things. It's a very powerful expression. Actually, I have found that once I got the hang of it and I started thinking in those terms or using it, it opened up many doors, actually. These two things do not stand against one another. Because in Buddhism, everything is inclusive. And, you know, I hope to sort of convey a little bit more of that as we talk a bit more. But I want to say and instead of but. Dogen talked about not spending so much time rubbing only a part of the elephant. I don't know if you're aware of that's an old Indian story about the blind man and the elephant. So these blind men got together and were asked to touch an elephant and see what, talk about what they thought this creature was. Well, every one of them had an entirely different understanding of what the elephant was, and of course none of them saw the whole elephant, so they all thought it was some, you know, separate, do you remember, Patrick?
Separate part of the elephant.
A separate part of the elephant. They thought the ear was, you know, a plant, and, you know, this kind of thing. The tail was a snake, etc. So that's what he means when he says, don't spend so much time rubbing only a part of an elephant, you know? I mean, it's like looking with one eye. And I had a very powerful example of this when a friend of mine who is very interested in politics was telling me about a book that he had read, which was a scathing biography of one of our late presidents a few terms back. And he said this book confirmed all his worst fears about this man, what he had gotten up to. He said, with the exception of one chapter. And in this chapter, the president made a visit to an elementary school in the South. And there were a lot of very poor kids there. And it's a long description about how he took all of his aides and they went and visited this school. And they all went in the classrooms and sat with the kids and talked with the kids and ate lunch with the kids, went out on the playground and played with them, talked with the teachers, and, you know, just spent the entire day in this school, he and his whole staff, getting a feel of what it was like for these kids in their life. And he said the description of this was so poignant, he said, that it brought tears to his eyes. And then he said, I hated that chapter. He said, that was the worst chapter in the book. So, you know, how many times are we in that situation? You know, the heart is responding to something and the head hasn't got any idea what to do with it. So what do we have to do in those situations? We've got to let go of our views and opinions. Give up everything, Dogen said. Think of neither good nor evil. Consider neither right nor wrong. So the thing is, we can't really talk ourselves into... Wait, what do I want to say about this? There's a certain way in which we can't force ourselves or talk ourselves into seeing things differently, but I think that, and I want to say and instead of but, the way we use our language is really a way in. And the reason I keep saying that about but is, and some of you have heard me say this 500 times, so bear with me if you have, because there's a few people here who probably haven't heard this before. When Reverend Master Hubert was translating our scriptures, Reverend Master Jiyu told him to use and instead of but whenever he could. She said, because it is inclusive. And in Buddhism, we are wanting to convey that sense of inclusiveness. So even in our Kesa verse, which we recite every morning, it used to be formless yet embracing every treasure. And around this time, she changed it to formless and embracing every treasure, because those two things do not stand against one another. So when I heard this, I started using it in my own thinking. You hear me struggle with this, I say, but then I say, wait a minute, and. It had a very profound effect on how I looked at things. And I said to Reverend Master Hubert one day, I've been practicing with this, and it's just like it opens up the door. And he said, well, it does more than that. It actually takes the door off the hinges. So try it. Try it. Just see what happens when you want to say but. Now, here is an example of how it can shift our thinking. People will often say something like, I love my brother, but he's got a terrible temper. You know, and where do you go with that? And if you say, I love my brother, and he has a terrible temper, the and somehow acts as a little bridge between the love and the temper. And there's something about it that opens up some possibilities about how we can relate to that in a more spacious, it's kind of more of a spacious view, isn't it? So just think about that, you know, just experiment with that and see see if it makes any difference. A lot of what we do is reframing situations. I think especially, you know, if people come to us for spiritual counseling, one of the things that we will do maybe is help them reframe their situation. And some of you have talked to me, may have heard me say something like, you just describe some really difficult situation to me, and I'll say, gosh, that sounds like a really juicy situation. Now, what I mean by that is, instead of thinking of it as awful, is there a way that you can think of it? How can I bring the Dharma to bear on this situation? And then it can have some juice in it. It can have some life in it. So I kind of got a sense of that years and years and years ago when I was a lay trainee and I'd gone to the Berkeley Priory, and I think Reverend Master Echo was there, and I described some situation to him that I thought was perfectly awful, and I thought he was going to agree with me, and he just looked at me and he said, oh, he said, well, that's unusual, isn't it? Well, that's kind of took the wind out of that. And I had to look at it again. You know? And so okay, so that's those are some ways we can help one another. You know, if a friend is bringing something to you, and you see this person is really stuck, and so are you, is there a way that you can think about it differently? I mean, we don't have to solve somebody's problem, but we sometimes can put it in such a way that it opens up some other doors to them to be able to see some possibility, see the potential. Yeah, that's really what a juicy situation is, a situation that has the potential in it. And of course, the gassho is really the ultimate mudra, or, you know, this is a mudra is a spiritual position that helps us in the way that we're holding our hands or bodies, has a spiritual aspect to it. And as Reverend Master Jiyu taught us, as soon as you put your hands together, it's like bringing both sides of your brain together. You are immediately in the place of meditation. You are in the third position. You have gone beyond the opposites right then. And if you really do it, it's very important. Put your hands together. Why don't you just try it for a minute? Put your hands together and don't let, with no space, no space for worry or fear, just put them together. It's a very powerful way of collecting ourselves and cutting through whatever state of mind we find ourselves in. It's also a way of asking for help. It's a way of offering respect to someone. It is a way of acknowledging the truth. We say Buddhism will last as long as bowing lasts. Okay, this is a form of bow. The gassho is a form of bow. If you actually bow right into it, the reason that we say that it will last as long as bowing lasts is because bowing is an understanding of the fact that there is something greater and that we are part of it, and we are acknowledging that which is greater than ourselves. So I want to mention, maybe I'll just be quiet for a minute. I want to mention a teaching that I think is very relevant to our times, and actually it's one of the teachings that brought me to Buddhism. Because when I was in my early 20s, I found myself in a state of despair because it seemed to me it was important to do something that was going to be really big and helpful to the world. But I couldn't think of anything that was big enough or important enough to do that I could do that was going to make a difference. And so when I came to Buddhism, I heard a teaching which changed all of that for me. And that is that no effort is wasted. And I began to see that from my own experience, that the smallest effort can be incredibly valuable. Now, this is really one of my favorite quotes from the scriptures, and it confirms this teaching. And here it is. This is from the Sutra of the Past Vows of Earth Store Bodhisattva. That's Kishtigarbha Bodhisattva. Some of you, or Jizo, as some of you may recognize him. At the time of his death, the Buddha said, "I have worked hard for many kalpas to liberate obstinate living beings. Those who have not yet understood the Dharma will surely fall into states of suffering." And Kishtigarbha said, "Even if their good deeds are as little as a hair, a drop of water, a grain of sand, a mote of dust, or a bit of down, I shall gradually help living beings to liberation. World honored one, do not feel distressed over beings in generation to come." And he repeated this vow three times. One of the things I love about this is the only scripture that I've ever read that has a bodhisattva comforting the Buddha. He's reassuring him. And the Buddha says, he was delighted and he said, "My blessings. I appreciate your strong vows and praise you for your efforts to heal the human world. When you fulfill this great vow after many kalpas, you will become a Buddha." Well, now the thing is that Kishtigarbha is not alone in this undertaking. As you see, here is, do we still have Avalokiteshvara with her thousand hands, which actually represent infinite hands. And I like to think of that because there's so many of them. Many of them are just doing one tiny thing. And all of those things are helpful. The reason is because we don't know where any other person is on their journey and what is going to help them. And one of the most profound confirmations that I had of that was, and again, some of you may have heard this story, but and when I was working in the guest office, a woman was here with her daughter. She'd been here before, and she loved coming here and found it incredibly helpful. She convinced her daughter to come. Her daughter was very, very depressed, and she was deeply worried about her. She was a young woman, and she had 5 kids, and she was deeply worried about her. So she convinced her to come, and she came for the weekend. And when the retreat was over, I said to this young woman, "How was the retreat?" And she said, "I saw the tallest monk in the monastery bend down to pick up a caterpillar out of the cloister so that it wouldn't get stepped on," she said, "and it gave me hope." I just find that that's a very moving. Sometimes that's all it takes. And here is this person just doing their own training, did not set out to do anything that was going to be helpful. This is why we say the merit of our training is beyond anything that we can imagine, and we simply have to trust that without having any idea. Reverend Master Dai, we used to say, put your offering on the altar and walk away. Don't look back and see if anybody took it off the altar. Just walk away. So recently we had there was a conference down in the Bay Area, and a few of our monks went down there and came back to say that they had met a very elderly professor down there who was a Buddhist, who had actually encouraged Reverend Master Jiyu to offer her talks through UC Extension. And that made it possible for so many of us to meet her. Many of us right here in this room met her there. Many of the monks met her. And, you know, I wonder if this man had any idea. Here are some
That's
folks.
An amazing story.
Isn't that lovely?
Yes,
yeah, because you were one of them.
Yes.
So many of her students, many of her disciples met her. She used to teach at UC in Berkeley, in San Francisco, in Santa Cruz, right? In Aptos, wherever she went, we would go and hear her. And I wondered, does this man have any idea? He probably said, "Gee, Roshi, it'd be a good idea if you think about it. You know, offer your talks through UC." And here, so many of all of us who met her there had a hand in building the monastery. And I don't know whether he knows or not. I don't know. I didn't go. You could ask Reverend Amanda or Reverend Master Jisho.
Because he was my teacher.
He could have been.
Someone.
Yes.
Okay.
Told you that story?
Well, the big dark message.
Yes.
Is all I remember.
Okay. It could very well have been. Yeah. Isn't that something? Yeah. So, you know, something about in difficult times and all, it is so helpful to remember the essential goodness that is constantly manifesting. This is also what is meant by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas constantly manifesting in compassion, manifesting all around us. Somebody said at a Dharma discussion that the cumulative effect of small acts of kindness create a very powerful momentum. And a couple of us were having a discussion, right? You'll remember this. Just a couple months ago, after a retreat here, Patrick and Beth and a few of the rest were sitting out at the picnic tables at the end of a retreat, and someone quoted a contemporary poet as saying that when we stop doing small acts of kindness, civilization is going to collapse. And then we had a wonderful session talking about stories of kindness and benevolence that we might not have noticed as such. And interestingly enough, having to do with driving. Okay, people are talking about road rage and the like. So our friend Gary from Portland, which is known, as I understand it, for its really, really intense rush hour traffic, said he'd been driving up there for years. And he said, in all of that time, no one had ever refused him the opportunity to change lanes when he had signaled that he wanted to do that. And then we began to talk about all of these... Do either of you remember, want to say anything about that?
Patrick, I think, had some examples.
I don't have a good memory.
He doesn't remember. All right. Okay. Well, the thing is, this is the thing, I'm so struck by that because that's what I love. I love the stories, the tiny details. I am less interested in the grand gesture because the tiny details are going on all around us. And so, you see, this idea that, how when you come to a four-way stop, everybody stops, right? And somebody signals somebody else to go ahead. And that person will often go ahead and then turn around and signal to the other person as a thank you. So these kinds of interactions are going on all the time. Now, it doesn't matter what those people's political beliefs are, right? We don't know, and it doesn't matter. And the fact that... that we are able to get out on the freeway and drive safely is a recognition of the fact that no matter what people are getting up to, they have for that period of time been willing to follow the rules of the road in such a way that we can get where we need to go most of the time in harmony. And people are often acknowledging one another with the waves. The way I always think of that is Buddha recognizes Buddha and Buddha bows to Buddha. And people usually smile when they're doing that. Now, I frankly agree with whoever that poet was. When we stop doing that, we're going to be in trouble. But I think that if we recognize, or when we recognize, those things are going on all around, we can take heart and be nourished by the essential goodness and good-heartedness that we all have and gets expressed in these ways that we may not even notice. If you go into the grocery store and there's you've got two items and somebody else has got a whole basket load, sometimes they'll say, do you want to come in front of me? So this is the underlying fabric. This is the thing that connects all of us. This is the thing that comes forth, I think, in response to natural disasters, in response to acts of violence, in response to any kind of situation in which people... come forth with all kinds of goodwill and concrete help the fires all have been all around us here, the outpouring of people just took clothes out of their closet and went over to Weed when there was an incredible fire over there and offered clothes and clothing, and actually so much that the folks who were dealing with the donations had to say, we don't have room for any more. So, but it was that moving. And incidentally, a very impressive thing happened. Reverend Master Ando and I went to the graduation of the Weed High School last year, the year before. This was the graduating class that came in when they were freshmen. That's when that devastating fire, I don't know whether you folks know about that, but that was one of the number of fires that happened here, and it practically wiped out the town of Weed, which is just across the freeway from us. So these kids came in when they were freshmen. They're now graduating. And the theme of everybody who spoke, from the teachers to the students, was what it was like to go through school in this time of reconstruction and connection with this community that was rebuilding itself, and how powerful an experience was for them. It was incredibly moving. And then I don't know if you folks remember the pomp and circumstance. Here were all of these kids, one by one. They were all wearing graduating gowns and hats, and some of these guys who looked like this was the last place in the world that they wanted to be dressed like they were. They came down the aisle you're supposed to do it step by step by step in time to the music, and every one of them did it. One of the most moving and joyful, ceremonies I've been to in a very long time. So, out of really disastrous circumstances, out of suffering, and the suffering of violence, and all of these things, people come together, as we see over and over again. So out of the horror of that recent attack on Christ Church in New Zealand came these incredible acts of solidarity toward the Muslim community all over the world. People went to mosques and just offered condolences. They offered donations. They offered support all over the world, in this country, in Canada. There were marches of support and solidarity. It brought people together, people of many different faiths, in a way that people would not have anticipated. So out of a concern about the fear and anxiety that has been stirred up about among various religious groups. So out of concern from that and some of the recent shootings, we have gotten together with some of the religious leaders here in Mount Shasta and said, let us see how we can begin to come together more often so that people can let go of their concern and fear and anxiety about one another. You know, back in Reverend Master Gia's day, she did bake sales. People came here and said, oh, here we are. People had never been to a monastery, but they like to eat cookies and chocolate cake. And, it was great. People in town still ask us, are you folks still doing a bake sale? We're not. We're not doing that. Times have changed, although I think it's still a good idea, and we may come back to it. But in the meantime, we recently had a vigil, an Avalokiteshvara vigil, which was an interfaith vigil, and we did a poster and posted it in town and invited people to come and offer prayers for the suffering that was going on in the world, and we chanted some invocations and offered merit. And we had to spend a fair amount of time looking through our invocations to see what was it that we could offer that people would be comfortable with. It was an interfaith invocation, in other words, that everyone felt that they could sing without feeling uneasy about making homage to the Buddha if they're not Buddhists. So, and I'm saying that because I think that's very important from the point of view, and somebody mentioned this yesterday, we're needing to find common ground among people who are very different politically and have different faiths. We do not have to have the same faith. We don't have to agree with one another. And we have to find common ground to come together. So there is another interfaith prayer service, which is going to be held at the Catholic Church. And that's going to be a musical offering. That's a taizé ceremony for some of you who may be familiar with that. That is a classic interfaith ceremony. And again, everybody looking at, okay, what can we all sing together that we can all join in together? And out of this, we then said, okay, well, we know that some people are not, some of the religious leaders in the community are not necessarily going to even feel comfortable going into one another's churches. So is there a common ground we can find that will still bring all of us together? And somebody had the idea, well, what if we come up with an interfaith directory? We could make a directory of all the different churches in Mount Shasta, put their addresses, their telephone numbers, and what they're offering, and then give it to the visitor center. Visitor center is always asking us for information. And this is a doorway in to be able to go and meet one another in a very, a very safe kind of way. So I think, you know, we are trying as best we can to think how to work with whatever situation is there. We also, on the environmental level, have joined a group called the California Interfaith Power and Light. This is a group of people, actually there's also an international, national branch. The California branch, we are getting to know. These are religious groups that want to join together, they say, as a religious response to global warming. And that is the focus. We're particularly interested in this group for two reasons. It's an interfaith group, and also this group is making an effort to not polarize around the political situations. And part of the way they do that is the language that they use in talking about issues. And not demonizing whatever the other sides, so to speak, or sides or whatever, an attempt to stay as neutral as possible. And for us, this is critical because Reverend Master Gio always taught us this is a contemplative order. And so we are open to anyone who wants to come here regardless of what their religious or political views are. We want to be a refuge for anyone. And so as soon as we take a side here, we can be putting off somebody there. So this is a sticky wicket for us, how to do this. And how to acknowledge what is going on and see where it is we can help. So I just want to say this last little bit about the California Interfaith Power and Light. Because we are members of this organization, our congregation is also automatically members. So I'm going to put a bit of information on the coffee table in the Vimalakirti Hall in case any of you are interested in finding out a little more about it.